Chapter 8. The Nature of Nightmares. Schola Mistress Valeria is stern, but she is beautiful in her sternness. Matthew watches her as she paces the long files of desks in the freezing Scholem Hall. She is one. The children are many, but they obey her without question. Not one of them speaks, not one of them daydreams. They hunch over their tablets, styli ploughing through the wax like the prows of silent boats on a voyage in search of knowledge. Partly they obey her from fear of her cane, whose sting they dread. Her temper is only marginally duller than the switch, and as quick to rouse and strike. It goes like this. First, her eyes widen, then her nostrils flare, then her shoulders set, as if all the impulses that stem from anger spill from the top of her head and cascade down her body like a flow of lava or an avalanche in the mountains, rushing down her arms to her hands, where, with nowhere else to go, her anger travels out along the cane, and thence, with a flash of movement, into the body of a wayward pupil. The first stroke is initially painless, a numb line that heats pleasantly before it sears. After the first, they all hurt. But the children also obey her from love as much as fear. They are fortunate, they know. The Scholem offers them a future different to their parents' miserable lives. To be gifted enough to be worthy of a ministerium education is a badge of honour, but to pass the exams, well, pass the exams, Matthew's father says, in those short minutes when they are both at home in the barracks and neither of them are asleep, pass the exams and high service awaits. Perhaps, he says, if Matthew works hard enough, he might one day have his own room to think in, and food that comes from the ground and not the nutrient plant. There are other schools. There are higher schools. There are more vaunted forms of service. The existence of these other institutions cannot dampen Matthew's ambitions. To be a priest and serve the God Emperor is his highest desire. Matthew does not want to let his father down. Matthew sees the exhaustion peeling away his father's youth. He sees the dirt in the lines of his father's face that he is too tired to clean off. He watches his father lose weight as the rations dwindle and the work doubles. Matthew doesn't want that kind of service. His service must mean something. He cannot be a forgotten number in mankind's teeming trillions. That would be a waste. This is pride. Pride in oneself is an affront to the emperor. Pride in service is acceptable, but Matthew's pride is not the virtuous kind. He hates the blows of Valeria's cane that come after his confessions, but he confesses to his sin often. He fears sharing his father's fate more than he fears Valeria's wrath. It is this fear, not that of the cane, that makes him work so hard. He loves Valeria for the route to a different life that she offers, and he loves her for her cane, because the pain makes him work harder. Service, pride and fear shape the clay of his soul. But there is one more sculptor at work. Matthew has a secret that he will not share with the other children, partly because he fears they will laugh, partly because he suspects he is not the only one, and he could not bear that. Matthew thinks Valeria is beautiful. Her physical allure is faded. Though she is not yet old, she is not young either. Her face is lined, her eyes sunken, her hair dry. These are the wages of endless toil. Premature age afflicts everyone that Matthew has ever known. Inside her, he perceives a light. He sees past her pinched expression. He sees the care she has for them, her desire for them to succeed and ascend the path education offers. She has faith. She loves the emperor, and she loves them because they will serve him. His young heart skips when she looks at him and gives the short, sharp nod of approval she reserves for success. He yearns for more. "The Emperor protects," she tells him, as he learns the naming of the Xenos and the hatreds reserved for each kind. The Emperor does protect Matthew. He remains while others fail and are taken away to fates the children dare not discuss. The years pass. His desk seems to become smaller, though in truth it is he who is growing. His handwriting becomes surer. With every erasure of the wax, he scrapes away a little bit of himself. Childhood years are overwritten with the story of manhood. He takes and he passes the tests. The number of children dwindles as the first stage of childhood passes. It dwindles again as they approach puberty, and then again as they become youths. 5 years, 6 years, 7, then 10. Matthew knows the Catechism Minoris by heart before all the others. He advances onto the Versus Majoris before he is 14 years old. By the time he is 16, he knows hundreds of blessings and psalms. His understanding of the histories of the church is deep and considered, and his reading of the tarot is bettered by only 3 of his classmates. Soon he will be 17. Mistress Valeria is older, just as he is older, but he finds her more heavenly than ever. When he thinks of her, odd thoughts trouble him, and he retreats to the scriptorium, where he may lose himself in illuminating the books the older children are tasked with copying, until the thoughts go away. 4 weeks before he is 17, there are 23 members of the class left. The rest fell by the wayside into other forms of service, inevitably in some cases, surprisingly in others. 23 men and women remaining from 200 boys and girls. They are to be priests. Matthew is joyous. He is proud. This new pride is of the acceptable sort. He has always been faithful. He has duties now, assisting in the cathedra, singing the plain song that raises acts of worship from duty to elation. But of them all, he most anticipates visiting the poorest members of society to hand out alms. Not because it amuses him. It is not amusing. It is grueling and humbling and altogether awful. Very few people are wealthy or even comfortable in the Imperium. Most endure levels of poverty that would shock men from the least enlightened of prior ages. The plight of those rejected by this brutal system is terrible indeed. Matthew finds a profound satisfaction in helping them, even if only slightly, even if it makes his own life harder. He gives away as much food as he can spare, though he has little to begin with. He gives away the cloth he is allowed to make his robes from. He becomes ragged. He gives away his sandals several times. Every time, after the second occasion, he is whipped. The pain is validation of his actions. The recipients of his charity are suffering, so he too will suffer. Matthew has found his calling. Fire alters his path. Fire is a rapid oxidization. Fire changes materials from one state to another. Wood and bone are made into gas and ash by fire. But fire changes subtler things too. Fire can change fate. Fire can change a soul. Fire transmutes lives. Fire comes from the sky. Fire and death and blood. No world is free of strife. No life is free of pain. No human being is free from change. He is out on the agri-farms, seeing to the bonded workers. He helps their bodies with gifts of food. He soothes their minds with beautiful words, and their souls are refreshed by his faith. The first he knows of the attack is the unnatural thunder of attack craft speeding down from orbit. They are quick and precise, knocking out air defenses and communications hubs before they land their ground troops to deal with the pitiful opposition. They are heretic Astartes, armored in blue and green. Their pauldrons bear the device of a many-headed serpent. Few in number, maybe 20, they are more than enough to kill the company of soldiers guarding Matthew's town 5 times over. They butcher the garrison with contemptuous ease. They make a show of it, Matthew thinks later. They linger. After they are done with the soldiers, they turn their attentions to the priests. They make for the Scolum purposefully and do unspeakable things there. Matthew lives because the poor hide him. When he begins to run down the muddy, unpaved road, they tackle him to the ground. They restrain him. They drag him away and bundle him into a grain silo, and they will not let him out until it is all over. It is brave what they do, and would earn them a painful death if the enemy did not depart, their mission done, leaving all unharmed but the priests and the soldiers. They set fire to the Adeptus Administratum officers and execute the chief official there, but leave the scribes. They make a speech. They are making a point. In the evening, the bondsmen release Matthew. The first thing he sees is the column of grey smoke piled up on itself, its eastern side golden with the setting sun. It is so thick it seems solid and therefore impossible. The narrow base should not support such a rippled mass. He runs towards it. This time the bonded workers do not stop him. There is confusion in the town. People are shocked, but they are grateful to be alive. Help has not yet come from other towns, and Matthew wonders dimly if similar acts have been committed elsewhere on the planet. That is a concern for later. First, he must see what has become of his fellows. He must see what has become of Valeria. He hurries up the hill, along streets whose river of cobbles make cartwheels roar. He goes into the great quadrangle of the seminary and passes through the portal into its scolum. The doors have been ripped off their hinges. The smell of smoke and meat mingle. Matthew is hungry, and his mouth responds automatically with a flood of saliva. He is ashamed. The roof has fallen in. The first stars are coming out where frescoes of the emperor were. The timbers of the scolum still give out a little heat. The younger pupils have been spared. They are variously hiding or roaming around in shock or weeping outside. But the older ones, those into the first years of manhood and womanhood, are all among the slaughtered. Matthew's classmates are dead. They have been butchered, imaginatively. The enemy were cruel, but they saved their most fiendish inventiveness for the mistress of the house, she who had turned empty vessels like Matthew into priests, filling them up with the emperor's love. His precious Valeria is in the middle of the corpses of her students, nailed to a chair painted a gaudy yellow. Her body has been opened from crotch to neck, the organs removed, so she looks like a bag with a red lining tastelessly made in a woman's semblance, rather than herself. Upon her forehead is carved in a shockingly neat hand, Deus Imperator. When he sees this, Matthew falls to his knees in the mixed ash and blood, and he weeps.
"Look at me," says a voice.
Matthew does not look up. He is too caught up in anguish. Valeria is dead. His love, his inspiration.
"Look at me," the voice commands.
This time, Matthew cannot help but obey. He has no choice. He turns slowly. There is a figure behind him in the scolum portal. Golden and bright, it turns ash into treasure and the ruin into a palace. The figure is out of place in this memory. An aura of perfect light burns from it so dazzlingly Matthew cannot discern any detail. Nevertheless, he thinks he knows who it is. His heart almost stops.
"Behold me, and pay heed, priest," says the being.
His voice is sweet thunder. His words are blissful pain.
"Through the agony of your memories and the sting of your dreams, I speak to you. Mark this well. On Parmenio I am. Find me, use me, and victory shall be assured."
Before the figure vanishes, or before Matthew wakes up, he is not sure which of those things happen, if either of them, he catches a glimpse of someone else. A young girl, not a child, but barely a woman. He can see her, though the hurtful light burns from her eyes as hot as a plasma forge.
"Find her. Find me," says the girl.
Then Matthew awakes in his chambers, and the past has become the past once again. It is in the nature of nightmares to disrupt a man's mind. Matthew could not rest after the dream. He prayed a while and subjected himself to the cleansing pain of autoflagellation for his remembered longing for Valeria. None of it helped. Finally, when the sixth watch klaxon rang, he scooped up Valeria's skull without engaging its mechanisms, and headed for the one place where he would not be disturbed.
"They have breached the hull! They are here!"
They were Sicarius's last words. After he had spoken those two short sentences, his world had changed, and he had changed with it. He was no longer who he had been. He wore the same face and carried the same name, but he was a different man. He was a man who still heard the screams. It did not used to be that way. His had always been a world of screams, screeching Xenos, wailing heretics, shrieking monsters to defy the imagination of mankind in the breadth of their horror and the heights of their malice. Dead or dying at his will, at his order, by his hand. Ruptured into extinction by the application of bolt, boot, and sword. Deaths, endless and innumerable deaths, they soaked his soul through and through in blood and pain. Sicarius never remembered the screams of those who died before the rift. He was righteous in their making. They did not trouble him. Those deaths were just. But the screams of his men, those he could not forget, and they troubled him deeply. Bitter saliva leaked from his betcher's gland. He swallowed the slow issue of his own poisons. The screams rang in his head, the high screaming of space marines in the red claws of agony. He expected normal men without the benefits of Adeptus Astartes' gifts to shrill so keenly when faced with death. But his brothers? He closed his eyes, bowed his head. He enumerated the dead, remembering those lost in the warp, and asked, foolishly perhaps, for the Emperor's forgiveness. A deep trance enveloped him. He remembered his brothers' faces and forced himself to live their individual deaths again as he fired and fell back, helpless to aid them. Immersed in past horrors, he only heard the priest at the last moment, and only when he coughed quietly to alert Sicarius, he was no longer alone on the observation deck. Sicarius looked up sharply with red-rimmed eyes. Matthew was a slender man, deceptively feeble in build, appearing almost a youth. He had the earnestness of a man yet to reach his 30th year, with a blend of hope and despair that marked out those who wanted to change the galaxy, but who could never coax the uncaring stars to move. Sicarius had seen him fight and knew the strength concealed beneath Matthew's patched robe. He had seen him speak. Matthew was a rare man the stars might heed. Sicarius twitched the fancy away as unworthy. Matthew was a man, Sicarius a space marine. And yet? Matthew's hair was shaved around the sides of his head, long and greased tall on top. This flopped over into Matthew's face, obscuring one of his eyes without diminishing his gaze. Matthew had an uncomfortable gaze. It implied no judgment, but left Sicarius feeling wanting. Matthew was cradling his servo skull. Had it been active, Sicarius would have assuredly heard the priest approach, but he carried it carefully in his hands, its systems powered down. The long fingers of one of Matthew's hands wrapped around ivory bone. The others idly traced the HV engraved into the forehead. The fingers, too, looked weak, the fingers of an aesthete, suitable for moving abacus beads and determining the fates of men he would never meet with a stroke of a pen. Many men had fingers like that. They were a destroyer's fingers, but not a warrior's. Another misapprehension. Matthew looked like a bureaucrat, unless one paid a little more attention to the marks on his skin. There, another story could be read. There were the calluses on his right-hand thumb and forefinger exacted by his chainsword in return for battle skill, and the notch on his left forefinger carved by the repetitive squeezing of a las pistol's trigger. Upon the back of his right hand was a crossed scar, an older and a newer wound joined together. At the base of his left, where wrist met hand to arm, a thicker line hinted at a horrific injury long healed. Sicarius was well versed in judging threat. The priest was anything but weak. "Captain Sicarius, isn't it?" said Matthew pleasantly. The two had been present in the same room on many occasions. Until that moment, they had yet to speak with one another. "Captain of the Lord Regent's Victrix Guard?"
"Yes," said Sicarius.
He examined his situation. He wanted to stay there, on his own. He did not want to share the space. He had assumed, not unreasonably, that an observation gallery would be the perfect place to be alone while the ship was in the warp, though there were other reasons for his choice. The shutters were closed. There was nothing to see. They were dangerously close to the edge. Who would want to go there? Theoretical, he thought. Matthew seeks the same solitude as I. But how much of the same? Simply solitude or more? He constructed a number of practicals to extricate himself from the situation. Irksomely, he did not wish to appear rude. If it were not for that, he would have simply walked away. So deeply ingrained was the theoretical practical model of dialectics into his habit that he utilized it without thinking. There had been times that the mode had fallen out of fashion within the Ultramarines, but it had never completely gone away, and Gilliman's return had seen its resurgence.
"It's terrifyingly close, isn't it?" said Matthew. "The warp, I mean."
The priest looked up at the plasteel shutters.
"Then he wants the same as I," thought Sicarius. "More than solitude." On the other side of that metal, outside the flimsy bubble of the Gellerfield, are the depths of the Empyrean, where the possible is but one among many, and the impossible is true, said Matthew. Sicarius glanced at the shutters as if he had not noticed them, although he had been staring at them unblinkingly for 2 hours and 3 minutes before he had shut his eyes.
There is only hell on the other side of that shutter, he said.
Oh, but there isn't, said Matthew, with a nervous smile. There's so much more. You say a hell, but there is holiness there as well. Out there, the light of the Astronomicon burns with a pure light that no evil thing can block. Evil flooded the galaxy, and it could not extinguish the light nor touch its source. He smiled again. Don't you think that's amazing?
You have come here to be closer to your God, stated Sicarius.
I have, said Matthew. He closed his eyes and arched his neck, basking in the light of the Emperor, as if it were flooding through the screened-off oculus. Sicarius's lip curled. He almost walked out then. Outrage rooted him to the spot. Outrage that this god-talker would come here and interrupt his meditation on the screams and speak of glorious light where there was only horror. How have the Space Marines managed to avoid the truth of the Imperial cult for so long, in the face of all the evidence? Asked Matthew, suddenly looking at him again.
What?
Said Sicarius, wrong-footed. There are so many miracles in the galaxy at this time. Why do you not see the Emperor's hand? You do not see him working for us on all our behalf. I am genuinely curious.
We are taught to be circumspect about miracles, said Sicarius, gruffly. They are rarely what they seem.
We have seen many in this campaign alone. Matthew's nervous smile was welcoming, the kind of smile that invited conversation and fellow feeling. Sicarius glowered at him, but the priest was not dissuaded. You yourself have seen the Damned Legion fight. You have been in the presence of the blessed Saint Celestine. These phenomena are given us by the Emperor.
I have seen what you might call miracles. You will not convince me, militant apostolic, that what I have seen during my service are inexplicable and therefore divine. Hundreds of times I've seen my brothers of the Librarius cast destruction at our enemies using the power of their minds. If I were to follow your reasoning, I would call them wizards and cower at their might, ascribing a divine origin for powers that are a part of the fact of this universe. The things they do are strange, uncanny by human measure, but there are many things in the material realm also that are bizarre. All works of artifice and sorcery are but the doings of sentient minds. If what you say is true, and the Emperor is a god, then so, in a small way, are Brother Tigurius and his ilk.
You are attempting to explain the inexplicable, a mistake made by philosophers and technologists alike throughout the ages. The warp cannot be explained, said Matthew. It is a realm unlike this, where dark powers clash with our most holy emperor. It is the stage for the performance of gods.
None of it is divine. There are things that call themselves gods. They are not. I have fought them. The emperor fought them. The emperor is a man. My lord Gilliman has told me so himself.
Matthew closed his eyes against the radiance of his emperor again, and laughed a little. Do you know Yasili Suleimania?
The rogue trader that serves Lord Gilliman's Logos. I have met her. I do not know her well. Why?
Matthew smiled and opened his eyes. She would agree with you.
The Primarch brings those of like mind to serve him, said Sicarius.
He brought me into his service, Matthew pointed out.
You are a necessary exception, Sicarius said.
An unwelcome one? The way Sicarius moved his head made his opinion clear. You find my faith objectionable, and that is understandable. But I am not guileless. The Lord Regent says he elevated me because the less exalted members of his crusade find me inspiring, said Matthew. The common soldiers, the lowest deckhand. I am glad. It is my vocation to serve the meek. But that is not the reason. The real reason is that having me in the role removes him from the influence of the High Church.
He is the Primarch. He is not influenced by anyone.
If only life were that simple, said Matthew. I do not think you are guileless either. You know life isn't that simple, I can tell. Again, Matthew abruptly changed the subject. Why are you here, in this viewing gallery, without a view?
Not for the same reasons that you are here, he said.
You were lost in the warp for a while, were you not? Sicarius gave him a sharp look.
You are well informed, too well informed. That knowledge is not widely shared.
I have the trust of high men. What was it like? Asked Matthew. Sicarius shook his head.
I cannot explain, and I do not care to try. I came back through secret ways to Macragge and returned to the service of my Primarch. That is all you need to know.
Matthew hugged his servo skull close to his body. This is an infernal age. We all have nightmares to contend with. You are not alone.
I am alone in what I saw. You ask why I come here. Very well, I will tell you. I come to show I am not afraid, and that I will have my vengeance on the things that killed my men. If it takes me 10,000 years, it will be so.
Is that why you come here unarmored, in your robes, to show contempt? Sicarius had had enough.
You pry too much, priest. My Lord Gilliman might indulge you, but I am not so inclined. Good night.
They are right to fear you. You are right to show them contempt. Matthew called softly after him, his voice shushed to one end of the gallery and back again. Be not afraid, Captain. Be joyful. The Emperor protects. Sicarius strode from the gallery. The Emperor had not protected his brothers, and no priest's words would ever silence their screams.